No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am Esti Dinur. Again, a two-part show today. Later in the hour, we will be talking with a Detroit journalist about an explosion in a refinery that didn't seem to make the news much, and we will explore it a little bit. But the majority of the show today will be dedicated to a new book, Beyond Belief, The Secret Lives of Women in Extreme Religions. We have with us on the phone and on Skype the two editors of the book, Kami Osman, a life coach, marriage and family therapist, author of Second Wind, One Woman's Midlife Quest to Run 7 Marathons on 7 Continents, and Susan Tive, who is a writer and editor for a variety of academic film and women's studies projects, as well as non-fiction book titles, including Faith and Feminism and Rachel's Bag. And hello, Kami and Susan.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, good to know that both of you are on and we can hear you. Let's start with you, Susan. What was the impetus for writing this book?
Well, Kami and I met in a memoir writing class, and we got to be friends, and we started talking about our... Both of us had been involved in extreme religions in our past, and as we started sharing our stories and talking to one another about our experiences, we realized that even though we had come from very different religious backgrounds, that we had been through, we had been through a lot of the same experiences through that process and that journey of getting into and then eventually leaving religion. So... Mm-hmm. The process of us talking to one another was very powerful, very healing, and we thought that there must be many other women out there who had been through a similar experience, and we wanted to widen the net and hear their stories, and so that's where the idea for Beyond Belief came.
Mm-hmm. And Kami, as you were getting stories and reading about the experiences of other women, did you find that there are similarities in these stories despite the different religions and sects that women were involved in?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I have to tell you, I have a really bad connection here. So if I ever don't answer a question, it's only because I didn't hear it.
Okay, but, it's a little hard to hear you, too. But
oh,
we'll do
okay.
Our best.
Yeah, we definitely did hear a lot of similarities between the different women coming from different perspectives, often around how they experience community or...
Kami, it really is very hard to hear you. I wonder if we can retry this connection and continue talking in the meantime with Susan?
Sure, yeah, talk with Susan, sure.
Okay, thank you. We'll... Yes, Susan.
I'd be happy to try to answer your question. We noticed a lot of similarities in the stories in Beyond Belief. In the, you know, for the getting in section or the stories around why women choose to enter into extreme religions, we felt that we saw similarities, and a lot of women were looking for structure. They were looking for community. They may not have had that in their family or in their growing up. They were looking for a way to lead a meaningful and purposeful life, and they weren't finding options in secular society that really were giving that to them. So those were kind of the main reasons why we noticed people joining and being attracted to extreme religions. Mm-hmm. As far as staying in. You know, extreme religions can be very isolating and very all-consuming. So once you're in a situation like that, it's hard to even contemplate leaving your family, all your friends, all your activities, and your very identity is tied up in that world. And so the thought of not being in there is just a very scary, difficult thing to imagine. And then as far as leaving, leaving is a long process. Many of the stories from our writers, they've been out of their religions for many years, and they still cycle around to feelings of failure and shame and guilt and confusion about, you know, what went wrong, and refinding them, their identity and their place outside of that structure. It's a long process that has, you know, its ups and downs, and also along with it, there's, you know, bitterness and anger and resentment for looking back at what their lives were like. And we also do have, you know, we have a variety of writers, and some walked away, closed the door, and never gave it a second thought. So we do, the book represents a variety of experiences all along the way.
Mm-hmm. Are there similarities in the way women's roles are perceived in all of these different religions and sects, or most of them?
Yeah, in most of the religions represented in the anthology, I would say the overwhelming similarity is sort of the second-class nature of women's roles within the structures, their lack of roles as leaders, emphasis on, you know, having children and being more of a traditional wife and mother role as opposed to being able to be a leader or a rule maker within that faith community. So there's variations of that depending on the religion itself, but for the most part, that's ultimately what begins to make many of the women wonder, did I make the right choice, or I have to get out of here? It's not fulfilling them as a human being after a certain point, and there's there's some struggle against that.
Mm-hmm. And I guess Cami is back with us on the phone.
I'm back.
Hi, good to have you back. However, that means that we can't get callers, I'm afraid, which is...
Okay, I'm sorry about that. I don't know why the Skype wasn't working.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll keep, as we keep talking with you, maybe we'll keep thinking about what to do. But callers, we would really love to hear from you, especially those of you who have experienced either being born to extreme religions or those of you who joined extreme religions and either left or are still in there, and relate your experiences to our phone answerer. And I will have to read it unless we can find through the hour a way to have both of our guests and talk to you too. And we'll try to find a way. So, Cami, back to you. Why don't you tell us your story? What happened? Why did you join? Who did you join? And what was it like?
Sure. Well, I was young. I was in the seventh grade, and my family was fairly chaotic. My mom and dad had gone through a divorce, and my mother had remarried, and there was a new baby in the family, and that was a really difficult time. The new marriage wasn't that great either, and I felt really like I was lost and wandering around without much guidance when a friend of mine invited me to church. And at first, it was a pretty mainline denomination, but I think because I was looking for so much structure, I sought out more and more structured experiences in the Christian community until, I was looking for rules around everything in my life. And so I was a member of a number of different communities over the years, but often they were, pretty patriarchal in nature and, pretty specific about how to live. And that really did work well for me for a number of years, but it also was very constricting and confusing because the answers that I was getting for really confusing questions were pretty black and white. And so, as I went on and got more education and got older, eventually I realized I needed to leave that perspective and the communities that I'd been a part of.
Uh-huh. And what was it like? How hard or easy was it to leave that community and get back to a different kind of life?
For me, it was hard, but it was mostly a matter of really unpacking the dogma in my mind. I still do have communication with a number of people from the old days, but for some of the women in our book, that's not the case. I mean, for some women, when they leave their dogma or their theology, they also might be shunned in their communities. I wasn't officially shunned, per se. I mean, there definitely were people who cut me off, and that was really sad. It was heartbreaking. I sometimes still feel really a lot of grief about that. But for the most part, for me, it was a matter of really looking at the world in a completely different way, and that was incredibly difficult to find a new paradigm to live by.
Mm-hmm. And how long did it take? To find that new paradigm.
I think years from the very beginning, the first doubts that I had until I really let some of the most excruciating beliefs go.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Susan? What is your personal story?
Well, I was born Jewish, but not religious in any sense. And I became Orthodox mostly because my ex-husband got very interested in practicing Judaism and converted, and kind of just that was the way it was going to be. There wasn't much discussion about it. And I didn't know enough about it to know one way or another. And as I learned, I guess what drew me to it was the sense of value. I had two small children at the time, and I was struggling to find a sense of myself as a mother in the larger world. There wasn't a lot of support, and I gravitated toward Orthodoxy because it was very different. There was a lot of value placed on being a mother, lots of value on children and families, lots of holidays and celebration, and just a huge amount of community support that I had not experienced before, which really supported me and in some sense empowered me. But ultimately there were trade-offs, and some of the rules around everything from what I could eat to how I could dress to my sex life to, how I had to raise my children ultimately began to, I began to struggle against that. And for me, the trade-offs just didn't add up. In leaving, it was very difficult because I kind of knew my relationship with my children would be in play, and I did not know how that would end. It was not necessarily the community itself, but the Orthodoxy that was an issue. And so, it was very difficult in that it would be years of a process to finally normalize my relationship with my children.
Mm-hmm. So they stayed in the religion?
They did for a while, and then ultimately they were able to have a normal relationship with me and be able to make those choices for themselves as they grew up. But At the beginning, there was a period of time when there was a lot of pressure on me to either continue to observe if I wanted a relationship with my children, or, you know, to fight against that and try to get them out of it as well. So it was a difficult, difficult
choice
decision to make.
Yeah. Well, Kami, let's start going into the stories of some of the other women in the book. Beaten by Devotion, Huda Al-Marashi. What is her story?
Her story is really interesting. She's got a in the book, she's written about a ceremony that she attends in which she really embraces. At first, she doesn't embrace the ceremony, and then eventually she embraces it. And part of the ceremony is that the women pretend to strike themselves, and she doesn't realize that they're pretending. So she actually does it, and then afterwards, her mother explains to her, of course, that it's more of a gesture and not an actual striking. But it's her moment of feeling really enveloped by the female culture in that moment. And it's a good example of how women are often those who indoctrinate and continue to support the next generation in engaging, you know, in the religion.
Mm-hmm. How about Susan Seducing God by Jashanda Victoria Sanders?
Hoshanda's story is she grows up with a religious mother who's Catholic, and Hoshanda is a woman of color, and she can't really connect with a white God, and her mother grows up homeless and without her, you know, much of a bearings and a structure. So she's, you know, searching for a faith that she can connect with that represents her as a young black woman, that gives her some kind of structure and meaning. And she gets attracted to Malcolm X and his church, and kind of, but then runs into the patriarchy of the Nation of Islam, and wants to belong to that, but has to struggle against her role as a woman within that faith. And ultimately ends up, you know, somewhat embracing the Nation of Islam, but also not quite sure that's going to be the right place for her as well. And so her story kind of points to really a woman's struggle to find a faith that is going to represent them, is going to feel like home, and give
really
them that sense of meaning and purpose that religion is, that we gravitate to religion for.
Mm-hmm. And I can't see it right now. I can't find it. But you have the story of Mooney. What is that story, Kami?
This Swan Sister.
Swan Sister, okay.
Right, yeah. Yolande Brenner has a really interesting story. She's a British woman, and she's been in America for many, many years. And she tells the story of her brother's mental illness and how he had a number of delusions that were very religious, you know, believing that he was a messenger from God and that kind of thing, and had a lot of adolescent questions. The story is told during the period of time when she's about 16 to early 20s. And, you know, that's a really common period for all of us to really be looking for meaning and trying to piece together, you know, what does it mean when evil happens in the world? And as she's grappling with those normal questions, she's also grappling with her brother's mental illness, and she encounters the Unification Church, and they are very, very welcoming and have a lot of answers for her, and they also offer her a community that's would protect her from many of the struggles. They basically promise her that if she does what she needs to do, what the church is asking her to do, that God will heal her brother. Mm-hmm. So that's a very fascinating story, and she, she goes into the church for a period of time. She's not still with the church, but she did spend some time there.
Yeah, and what were her experiences there in the church?
Well, one of the things that that they did was they spent a lot of time on the street raising money for the church's mission. And so she went out on the street and did a lot of begging and trying to, solicit money for the church. And even though as time went on, she understood that some of the things they were raising money for might not be things that she believed in, she still believed that the church's mission was ultimately going to be able to heal her brother. And in the story, what we read about is her begging and basically having to really forsake her outside life, all of her old friends and everything, in order to be a part of this community.
Mm-hmm. And I have a couple questions, though not stories yet from our listeners, but one question is, what causes people to conform so awkwardly to change? Who are they? Well, the sense, I think the caller is asking for a sense of some similarities in personality, or why would people conform to something that doesn't really feel right?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I think in the beginning it often does feel right, and that's the draw, that many of the women who wrote for this book joined their respective religions during really formative time periods in their life, when they were either adolescents or young adults, and they were looking for a place of connection. So in the beginning, they're looking for many things, structure in my case, connection, support in Susan's case. And so in the beginning, it does feel right in a way. People might be surrounded with others who really care about them and love them, and you don't normally get all of the baggage all at one time. And so it's little by little that you understand, I'm no longer allowed to have male friends once I get married, for example. That was one of the things that I grew to believe. I shouldn't have any male friends once I was married, so I had to dismiss all of my friends from high school and junior high and distance myself from all of them. So in the beginning, when I first took up with my faith, I didn't imagine that it would restrict me in that way. I didn't know. So I think that it's a matter of a growing discomfort, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Would you add to that, Susan?
Yeah, Susan.
I would agree with that. I don't know that I would. Every story is unique. Like I said earlier, some women are looking for community, some for structure. I don't necessarily think that it's a flaw or some kind of weakness in women that they are looking for answers in a faith. I actually can see it as a strength, as people, women wanting their lives to have meaning and purpose beyond maybe the opportunities available to them in the secular world. So it's, you can look at it as they're trying very hard to contribute. They want to do good things in the world and with their lives, and they see religion as providing them that opportunity where they can't find it elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. I guess maybe I can add to the caller's question, just thinking about my own personal experiences, and I can say that several times in my life I was on the verge of joining some religion or some sect or following some very convincing man. But I never actually crossed that threshold, and I'm thinking, how do we raise our daughters not to be tempted by things that are extreme? Definitely to seek the spiritual life and to walk in spiritual ways, but without succumbing to basically, it seems to me, one of the similarities in all of them is and really in religions generally, though this is changing a little nowadays, is they're run by men who seek power and often sex and money. So I don't know. I guess I'm kind of babbling here, but one question really is can we protect our daughters from being lured by those specific, what you call extreme religions, and whether things like a stable family life, raising children in stable family life to the degree that we're able to do it, of course, is a remedy. Yes, please.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that, I mean, my first response is, educating our daughters so that they know what they're getting into. Yes, there's the draw of that meaning and that place in community. But what a lot of, women didn't know is the downside to that. So people being more open with, how religions do really work. And I think that that's kind of happening more in our society with, to some extent, with the religions unraveling because they're not adapting to the times and the needs of women. You see it in the Catholic Church. And I think it's happening, and there's an active feminist movement within Mormonism and in Orthodox Judaism that women are beginning to demand changes. So there's more awareness about the patriarchy and the systems in place that aren't so good for women, and I think there's movements afoot in many religions to try to do something about that. So I think it has to happen from within by making these religions more egalitarian, for lack of a better word, which is probably going to happen at a glacial pace. And also for, women like us who have been in it to come out and say, this is what it's really like. So if you're going to make this choice, make it with all the information that you need, knowing what the benefits and the disadvantages are so that you know what you're getting yourself into.
Mm-hmm. I want to just take it a step further. I heard a few weeks ago, it was the anniversary of the attack on the Jim Jones compound, and the BBC actually had an interview with a man who survived. And as it turns out, his daughter, who was 14 at the time, was chosen by Jim Jones as one of his many wives. And the man still believes in him. No, it wasn't Jim Jones. I'm sorry. It was the David Koresh compound. I'm mixing my profits here. And so she was chosen to be one of his many wives or concubines or whatever they were called at there. And the man still believed in David Koresh. And when the interviewer asked him how he felt about his 14-year-old daughter basically being raped by Koresh, he said he had an explanation. I don't even need to repeat it. I just the fact was he had an explanation, he had a justification, and what that brought to mind for me was, do we need to really teach our children, girls and boys, to question authority and to be able to have critical thinking, which I think is not at all part of the American educational system.
Yeah, I was going to say earlier that, you know, for me there was a long period of time, almost 20 years, where I didn't listen to music that wasn't faith-based, where I didn't read books that weren't faith-based. And when I went to graduate school and I read bell hooks and Naomi Wolf and, you know, just some of the sort of popular feminists that are out there, I felt this opening up inside of me, you know, just, and I couldn't believe that I'd been to college. I just couldn't believe that I hadn't been exposed to people who thought so radically different. And I grappled with what they were saying at the time, but it also stretched me and made me really ask some hard questions. And so I was, you know, thinking about your earlier question that, you know, a lot of times if, you know, in some faiths, in many faiths, especially extreme religions, people are segregated from the outside world. And so if everything you're reading and listening to and thinking about and talking about is only with one perspective, then you're not developing critical thinking skills at all. You're not, you know, you're nothing that disagrees with what you believe is in your awareness, so you don't have to grapple with it. And to me, one of the great gifts that we can give our sons and daughters is to expose them to all kinds of things and be in conversation with them about all of that. How do you decide what you believe and what you don't believe? What's the process? Not just what do you believe, but how do you decide that? So I think, you know, that whole issue of critical thinking and being exposed to lots of things is such a big, important thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have just about enough time to have each of you share another, maybe just one story from the book that you think is interesting. Susan, which one would you like to share?
Well, that's a hard choice.
So many good ones.
Yeah, there's so many good ones. Let's see.
I have one if you want to think about it.
Yeah, okay. Why don't you go ahead, Cami?
One of my favorites in the book is Always Leaving by Donna Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Donna has her own book called Holy Ghost Girl out, and she was raised in a tent revival community that traveled around, you know, sawdust on the ground with a big circus tent, and the prophet was the leader of the community. And she writes about the experience in the story Always Leaving in the last section of our book. And I think one reason that I really love that story is because it captures the complexity on a really deep level. The tone of the story is one of both kind of a longing for what was, and yet also her knowing that she can never go back and that she doesn't want to go back, and just how it's kind of, Susan often says this when we're, you know, when we're talking at bookstores, but that, you know, you can take the girl out of the religion, but you can't take the religion out of the girl, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. That there's a part of her that is always with this community that she was raised in. And I think I just really love the complexity of all of that, you know, that you make a decision that's perhaps better for yourself to leave, in the case of the women in our book, but there's the connection still.
Mm-hmm. And Susan, have you chosen one?
Yeah. One story that really speaks to me is A Mother in Israel by mm-hmm. Stephanie Durden Edwards, and it's in the Burnt Offerings, which is the middle section that is more or less describing the experience of women staying within a religion even when they begin to have some serious doubts. And I think that's just, it's a very personal and difficult situation to be in and to express in writing.
is even more difficult. And I think Stephanie does a great job in that story. You just feel her going, vacillating and going from one end to the other, being ready to leave and then thinking about her family and her children and, chafing against the doctrine that she's being told and knowing deep in her heart and in her intuition that it's not right, but, also loving her community and being really, looking outside the doors and wondering, is there a place for me? Is there even anything better than this if I did choose to leave? So I think that her story really opens up, again, as Cammie said, the complexity of being in that without sort of victimizing or, woe is me kind of thing, but really clear-sightedly putting you in that really complex emotional place.
Mm-hmm. And what tactics do women share for really being able to, if you will, cleanse themselves of the years that they spent in these situations?
As we've been traveling around and doing readings, we often have many people in the audience who come up to us afterwards, and they've left a religion of one kind or another, and they're really, everyone is kind of to some extent on their own. There's common aspects to the experience, but I had a young man just a few weeks ago ask me for advice. How do I get through this? I feel really disoriented. I'm confused. I'm having a really hard time. And the best advice I could give him was, this is going to take a while. You listen to those voices that kept you in for a long time. You just need to be very, very patient and very, very kind with yourself and know that it's a process that's going to take a long time. Mm-hmm. But that, you have to have the faith that you did the right thing and that you will grow stronger as you move away from it.
Yeah. Well, Susan Tive and Cammie Osman, both authors, their stories are in the book. They are the editors of Beyond Belief, The Secret Lives of Women in Extreme Religions. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I would like to open the lines to you all and see if you want to share with us your experiences in extreme religions or sects and what you learned, maybe what got you in there and what you learned from it and what advice you can give to our listeners about these situations. We may still hear from Brian in Detroit, but we may not, and we have only about 12 minutes left. So would be very interested in hearing your experiences, Dior. If you had other thoughts during this conversation that we had with the two editors of the book Beyond Belief, I would like to hear from you about that. It's a little different from what we usually talk about, but it seems an important topic because especially here in the United States where religion has such an incredible role in people's politics and in what people are willing to do. And, of course, not just here. We saw Boston. So many people injured and some dead due to the behaviors that a convert to Islam has taken upon himself, and one can say that the fact that Americans don't care much about their own government doing the same and worse in the Muslim world. The American military is full of Christians, of fundamentalist Christians who feel that they are engaged in a holy war. So it's important, I think, to understand what takes people in these directions. We have a caller. Hi, caller, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a little personal experience of extreme religion, and something my nephew was telling me about nature coming to the rescue, like these radiation-eating mushrooms or oil spill eating bacteria, and there was a third example he gave. I'm just kind of harkening back to the idea of toxic shame, and toxic shame is something that can, you know, become addictive, like a Stockholm syndrome kind of addiction to shame, because it gives you kind of a perverse thrill, but then if you're able to get those beneficial bacteria in your life, those radiation eating mushrooms, to eat those things for you, help you along, to help repopulate your spiritual gut, an antibacterial ravaged gut that's, thrown off your spiritual immune system. That's where I was going with that. Thank you.
Okay, so wait. Don't go, because you've been speaking in parables, and I think I understand some of them, but you were talking about toxic shame, and you're talking about you're giving that parable of radiation eating mushrooms and so on and so forth, and you were talking about the Stockholm syndrome, which is the syndrome of, for example, people who have been kidnapped, like the women in Cleveland. Tend to, once they are released, or it's true for prisoners of war too, etc., once they are released, tend to have very mixed feelings towards their captors, their tormentors, because there were also kind moments and tender moments, and these are also the only people they had connection with for a long time. So Put all of this together for us, and maybe just through your own personal experience, you can explain what you mean by toxic shame and Stockholm syndrome and these mushrooms. Put it maybe in more concrete terms, if you will.
They say that by the year 2050, we'll need however many planet Earth, because we're consuming our natural resources at an unprecedented rate. And so the only solution that the powerful ruling elites would have is to reduce the world population, like we're little rats, like in the film Ratatouille, and that's their solution. But if you're the rat and you're this genius Remy in the film Ratatouille, he's got the gift of synesthesia and he's a genius, and it's a parable. This food critic, Anton Ego, he bridges that gap. And because he's the voice of Peter O'Toole, he bridges that gap. He's the powerful genius skeptic, and he has this synesthetic flashback to his childhood when he takes that bite of the ratatouille prepared by Remy. And suddenly, his spiritual gut has been repopulated with this brilliant spiritual flashback to his childhood. And if we could have the vision quest that is so outlawed in our culture, where people could realize that they're not little rats on a wheel, and that they're human beings and they need to stand up and take back the world. And if not, I believe in God, you know, G/D, you know, I'm a whatever believer in the Christ and all that. And, you know, so I have a, you know, an idea that, okay, you know, the battle's already won, and you know, I mean, the war is already won, and you know, all these bastard ruling elites that want to win all these little battles and make us feel like little rats. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, that's just it's a really extreme opinion that I just shared. Like the Fukushima thing, like they want to make it look like an accident. I know that's extreme. That's just my own personal opinion. Like they want to build all these nuclear reactors all the world. Like Cecile Panetta said, you know, like it's already a nuclear war, and they don't need to drop bombs. They just need to build all these, you know, dirty nuclear facilities all over the world, and put them with known design flaws on fault zones like in Japan, and then Japan becomes the pawn, the fall guy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm sorry,
well,
that's kind of extreme, and I didn't really want to go there, but it was something in the back of my mind, and I'm glad that we have radiation eating mushrooms.
Yeah.
And that, like in the film The Incredibles, a Disney Pixar, Disney Pixar film.
Uh-huh.
Like he's always having to clean up the messes. Heroes are having to clean up the messes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks
Kind of stupid.
Well, just a little hard to understand, I think. But thanks for your call. If anyone else wants to share their experiences in the last 5 minutes, we would welcome your call. In the meantime, I suppose I can tell you about Detroit and why we wanted to talk to the reporter. There was an explosion on April 30th in a refinery, the Marathon Refinery, which is situated right within a neighborhood among people. Even before the explosion, the refinery, which nowadays refines crude that comes from Canada, from the tar sands. So even before the explosion, the refinery has been responsible for a lot of pollution and for a lot of cancer and pulmonary diseases in the area. And it also has produced a lot of petroleum coke, which is found in the Detroit River, but Marathon, the refinery, denies responsibility for environmental effects of that because the pet coke, as it's known, was bought by Coke Minerals LLC. So there's a lot of things coming here together. The dirty fuel that comes from the tar sands, which of course is devastating a huge area in Canada, and coming here to Detroit, which is a devastated city, and polluting with help from the Koch brothers, and just kind of maybe to follow our last caller, it raised in me the thoughts of everything is wrong about coke. You know, there's coke petroleum that is being bought by the Koch brothers, and Coca-Cola is really bad for you, let alone cocaine, you know. So it's just, I would stay away from anything that's called coke, really. But beyond that, so turns out that it took probably longer than it should have to deal with the fire there, because Detroit has been cutting funding for fire workers, and also the only trained fire safety specialist in the in the refinery, retired, and because of budget cuts, was not replaced. And, you know, so it's all very interesting, and also interesting that it wasn't in the news at all. I don't know that anyone even mentioned it. And so I wanted to talk about that because it again, it seems to be putting a lot of signs of our times together. And the refinery is still working, from what I understand, and continuing to pollute the neighborhood. So I think we're out of time. I'm Esti Dinur. I want to thank Mark and Lois and Halvard and Sybil. And let the guys come and cheer you up with their dark humor. Bye-bye. Ain't a thing in the world that I can do. Don't you know the big bee is burning? Ain't a thing in the world that Johnny can do. Hometown running down to the ground, Western and Vietnam. Well, it started on 12 and Claremont that morning. I just don't know what it's all about.